So we're in chapter 9, the release from the ego. And so shall we presume that we're partially released from the ego? We've got a few pages into it now. In the sentence that we left, Sri Aurobindo had written, but it is in itself a secondary aim, to find, know, and possess the divine existence, consciousness, and nature, and to live in it for the divine is our true aim and the one perfection to which we must aspire. So to know by identity what is the essence of our true being, to live from that, for the divine. That is the fulfillment that we seek in every phase of our lives and every particle of our being. So it's based upon a realization which arrives to us through experience. It is not a thing where we get smart by reading 5,000 books. It is not aparavidya. It is the supreme knowledge. It is paravidya. This is what takes us beyond ambiguity into certainty, into the truth of reality in spirit and in nature. So Sri Aurobindo continues his essay, it is then in the way of the spiritual philosophies and religions, not in that of any earthbound materialistic doctrine, that the seeker of the highest knowledge has to walk, even if with enriched aims and a more comprehensive spiritual purpose. But how far has he to proceed in the elimination of the ego? In other words, is its subordination, is its reduction to mere egoism sufficient? In the ancient way of knowledge, we arrive at the elimination of the ego sense, which attaches itself to the body, to the life, to the mind, and says of all or any of them, this is I. This is the process of disidentification that he's been describing to us page after page. Not only do we, as in the way of works, get rid of the eye of the worker and see the Lord alone as the true source of all works and sanction of works and his executive nature power, or else his supreme Shakti, as the sole agent and worker. But we get rid also of the ego sense, which mistakes the instruments or the expressions of our being for our true self and spirit. But even if all this has been done, something remains still. There remains a substratum of all these, a general sense of the separate I. Substratum's an interesting word. It means a substance in which all associated qualities inhere. So in other words, there is this, well, let's go on another sentence. This substratum, ego, is something vague, indefinable, elusive. It does not or need not attach itself to anything in particular as the self. It does not identify itself with anything collective. It is a sort of fundamental form or power of the mind, which compels the mental being to feel himself as a perhaps indefinable, but still a limited being, which is not mind, life, or body, but under which their activities proceed in nature. So it is something that is not fixed, is not determined yet. It has a sense of itself as being limited, small, but not pocketed in any single location. It is fundamental, but is it foundational? The others were a qualified ego idea and ego sense supporting themselves on the play of the Prakriti. But this is the pure fundamental ego power supporting itself on the consciousness of the mental Purusha. So the architecture here is that there are elements of mind, life, and the physical being which have a sense of egoness, but it is derived from the substratum of ego, which is itself supported by the mental Purusha, the Manomaya Purusha. Now we know that this telescopes back and back into more and more interior realities, but this is where we find the nascent power of the ego. He continues, and because it seems to be above or behind the play and not in it, because it does not say, I am the mind, life, or body, but I am a being on whom the action of mind, life, and body depends, many think themselves released and mistake this elusive ego for the one, the divine, the true Purusha, or at the very least, for the true person within them, mistaking the indefinable for the infinite. Lovely turn of phrase. So this again is the ahamkara, the I-maker, which in English we translate as ego. But it is this sense of self, ambiguous perhaps, but above the constructed elements of how it interfaces with the rest of Prakriti's play. It is itself a formation of Prakriti, but it draws what it thinks to be its power, its light, its reality from the Purusha behind, and is convinced of its own dominion, of its own secure status as a real being. But so long as this fundamental ego sense remains, there is no absolute release. The egoistic life, even if diminished in force and intensity, can still continue well enough with this support. If there is the error in identification, the ego life may, under that pretext, get rather an exaggerated intensity and force. So this can lead to a kind of essential or spiritual ego, which is the most dangerous kind. Even if there is no such error, the ego life may be wider, purer, more flexible, and release may be now much easier to attain and nearer to accomplishment, but still there is as yet no definitive release. It is imperative to go farther, to get rid of this indefinable but fundamental ego sense also, and get back to the Purusha, on whom it is supporting itself, of whom it is a shadow. The shadow has to disappear, and by its disappearance, reveal the spirit's unclouded substance. So he is unrelenting. One must get all the way back to the essence of conscious being. If that isn't secured, there is no liberation from thraldom to nature, from mistaking what you are. You sit in a way station thinking you have arrived at your destination. Now, that substance is the self of the man, called in European thought the monad, in Indian philosophy, jiva or jivatman, the living entity, the self of the living creature. So, the substance he speaks of here is the real being. The monad, of course, is a phrase that goes all the way back to Greek philosophy, from the term monas, which means unit. And Pythagoras used it in a way that was the incipient number in a series of numbers. So it would be the first number, the monad. Philosophically, we find it becoming important by the time of Giordano Bruno in Western philosophy. Since he's fixing this in Western philosophy, let's touch upon this. Giordano Bruno described it as an ineradicable unit which had ontological reality. So it was a real individual being. And you'll remember that Giordano Bruno was a renegade monk who found his way to England, etc., and then brought back to Italy by circumstances, was burned to death in the year 1600 because he dared to go beyond the idea of the monad and say that the universe was an infinity whose center was everywhere. So such outrageous ideas could lead you to perish 400 years ago. Bruno was a great mystic, taking up some of his ideas. Leibniz, who was a 17th, 18th century philosopher, following not just Bruno, but also Paracelsus and Van Helmont, derived a kind of mathematical infinite in which all takes place by degrees. So you have a graded hierarchy of monads extending down from God to the lowest monad and then extending up. So it's a kind of integrated philosophy that Leibniz saw. And for his monadology, you know, the soul had a great importance as one of the highest monads in the whole chain of existence. We'll leave aside Goethe, who also found the monad important for his philosophy, and come now to the idea of the jiva. The jiva, of course, appears in a number of Upanishads, and there it means the living being, usually. In the Bangala Upanishad, which is rather late, it seems to mean something more, and we find there the idea of a jivan mukta, which is a possibility to live in the freedom of the Supreme Being. At the same time, one lives upon earth. So a conjunction between that and this. For Sri Aurobindo, the mention of jiva or jivatman leads us to the life divine, where it's described in the triple status of the supermind, And also in a later chapter, The Origin of the Ignorance, the Jivatman is the individualization of the universal transcendent self. It is supernal. It is above the play of time and circumstance. But it is, in this sense, a monad. It truly exists, but it exists contextually. It is in the Supreme Being. One with that. To read more, go to Letters on Yoga, Volume 1. There's an entire section. Section 3 deals with the Jivatman and the psychic being. Begins around page 55. You should read it and then read it again. And each time you read it, plunge in your meditation within and get behind the superficies of being and wend your way backwards to your real source. When you find your psychic being, you can be led upwards to that from which you came, from that Jivatman, that reality above, which is always one with the Supreme Divine. Anyway, we'll see that he takes this up again a few chapters from now in a discussion of the cosmic consciousness, where the Jivatman is a linkage between the transcendent, the cosmic, and the individual, the three great terms of existence. So, let's start again with this sentence. That substance is the self of the man called in European thought the monad. In Indian philosophy, jiva or jivatman, the living entity, the self of the living creature. This jiva is not the mental ego sense constructed by the workings of nature for her temporary purpose. It is not a thing bound as the mental being, the vital, the physical are bound by her habits, laws, or processes. The jiva is a spirit and self superior to nature. It is true that it consents to her acts, reflects her moods, and upholds the triple medium of mind, life, and body, through which she casts them upon the soul's consciousness. But it is itself a living reflection or a soul form or a self-creation of the spirit universal and transcendent. The one spirit who has mirrored some of his modes of being in the world and in the soul is multiple in the jiva. Sri Aurobindo makes an unspoken or uncited reference here to the Bhagavad Gita and the Purushottama. This is in the 7th chapter, and the shlokas involved would be 3, 4, and 5. Let's read 3 and 5 in English. Among thousands of men, one here and there strives after perfection. And of those who strive and attain, one here and there knows me in all the principles of my being. Then he describes the eightfold nature of Prakriti. He continues in verse 5, this the lower, but know my other nature, different from this, the supreme, which becomes the jiva, and by which this world is upheld. So here's that conjunction again between the individual in the cosmic in the transcendent. And by the way, this rings loudly of sentence that he would put into Savitri years later. The Gita, among thousands of men, one here and there strives after perfection. And so in Savitri, one among many thousands never touched, engrossed in the external world's design, is chosen by a secret witness eye and driven by a pointing hand of light across his soul's unmapped immensitudes. Book One, Book of Beginnings, Canto 5, The Yoga of the Spirit's Freedom and Greatness. In my book, that's on page 80 if you want to see it. So, also let's note that he says in the Gita, Krishna speaking as Purushottama, knows me in all the principles of my being, not just in my essence, not simply my transcendence, not simply the unmixed, unabrogated, undivided self, immaculate in self-radiance, but all the principles, the ways that self, the ways that supreme being pours itself out, stadia of light, power, and bliss, forming world after world within plane after plane, all the way down into matter, all of it expressive of a divine nature, of a para prakriti. So, the one spirit who has mirrored some of his modes of being in the world and in the soul is multiple in the jiva. That spirit is the very self of our self, the one and the highest, the supreme we have to realize, the infinite existence into which we have to enter. And so far, the teachers walk in company, all agreeing that this is the supreme object of knowledge, of works, and of devotion, all agreeing that if it is to be attained, the jiva must release himself from the ego sense, which belongs to the lower nature or maya. But here, they part company, and each goes his own way. The monist fixes his feet on the path of an exclusive knowledge and sets for us as soul ideal an entire return, loss, immersion, or extinction of the jiva in the supreme. The position of Advaita Vedanta, where again the drop merges into the ocean and disappears. The ray reverses course, turns around and places itself back in the sun and is no more. The dualist, or the partial monist, turns to the path of devotion and directs us to shed indeed the lower ego and material life, but to see as the highest destiny of the spirit of man, not the self-annihilation of the Buddhist, not the self-immersion of the Advaitin, not a swallowing up of the many by the one, but an eternal existence absorbed in the thought, love, and enjoyment of the Supreme, the One, the All-Lover. Well, that wonderful phrase at the end is more fitted to Vishishtadvaita than to Dvaita. Because there, at least in qualified non-dualism, one gets to be in deep communion with the Supreme Being. But in Dvaita, you get to dwell in a heaven always regarding and worshiping that being which you can never quite attain to. For the disciple of an integral yoga, there can be no hesitation. As a seeker of knowledge, it is the integral knowledge and not anything either halfway and attractive or high pinnacled and exclusive he must seek. He must soar to the utmost height, but also circle and spread to the most all-embracing wideness, not binding himself to any rigid structure of metaphysical thought, but free to admit and combine all the soul's highest and greatest and fullest and most numerous experiences. If the highest height of spiritual experience, the sheer summit of all realization, is the absolute union of the soul with the transcendent who exceeds the individual and the universe, the widest scope of that union is the discovery of that very transcendent as the source, support, continent, informing and constituent spirit and substance of both these manifesting powers of the divine essence and the divine nature. Both individual and universe. Whatever the path, this must be for him the goal. The yoga of action also is not fulfilled, is not absolute, is not victoriously complete until the seeker has felt and lives in his essential and integral oneness with the Supreme. One he must be with the divine, both in his highest and inmost, and in his widest being and consciousness, in his work, his will, his power of action, his mind, body, life. Otherwise, he is only released from the illusion of individual works, but not released from the illusion of separate being and instrumentality. As the servant and instrument of the divine, he works. But the crown of his labor and its perfect base or motive is oneness with that which he serves and fulfills. The yoga of devotion, too, is complete only when the lover and the beloved are unified and difference is abolished in the ecstasy of a divine oneness. And yet in the mystery of this unification, there is the soul existence of the beloved, but no extinction or absorption of the lover. It is the highest unity which is the express direction of the path of knowledge. The call to absolute oneness is its impulse, the experience of it, its magnet. But it is this very highest unity which takes as its field of manifestation in him the largest possible cosmic wideness. Obeying the necessity to withdraw successively from the practical egoism of our triple nature and its fundamental ego sense, we come to the realization of the Spirit, the Self, Lord of this individual human manifestation. But our knowledge is not integral if we do not make this Self in the individual one with the cosmic Spirit and find their greater reality above in an inexpressible but not unknowable transcendence. The jiva, possessed of himself, must give himself up into the being of the divine. The self of the man must be made one with the self of all. The self of the finite individual must pour itself into the boundless finite. And that cosmic spirit, too, must be exceeded in the transcendent infinite. So he insists on all of these coming into point. The cosmos consciously rejoins the transcendent through the awakened individual. Your work is priceless. Your yoga fulfilled is meaningful. You join all the spheres together. You are the bright point of linkage. This cannot be done without an uncompromising abolition of the ego sense at its very basis and source. In the path of knowledge, one attempts this abolition negatively by a denial of the reality of the ego, positively by a constant fixing of the thought upon the idea of the one and the infinite in itself, or the one and infinite everywhere. Constant fixing of the thought. That's meditation, no? So this is apt for your meditative practice. When concentrating, where is this one? Where is it not? In its essence, in universal extension, if constantly you seek for this one, you find it everywhere. The object of your meditation is everything. The period of your meditation is always. The fruit of your meditation is the delightful recognition of the identity of being, endlessly distributed, always contained in the essential oneness of Brahman. This, if persistently done, changes in the end the mental outlook on oneself and the whole world, and there is a kind of mental realization. But afterwards, by degrees, or perhaps rapidly and imperatively, and almost at the beginning, the mental realization deepens into spiritual experience, a realization in the very substance of our being. Remember Sri Aurobindo reading Müller's translation of the Upanishads while he was in England, came upon a mental realization of what is the self, the Atman. But it is when he experienced it, having returned to India, that it became of substance to him. More and more frequent conditions come of something indefinable and illimitable, a peace, a silence, a joy, a bliss beyond expression, a sense of absolute impersonal power, a pure existence, a pure consciousness, an all-pervading presence. Yes, this is Satchit-Ananda poured out into self-expression through its power of Chit-Shakti, conscious force. The ego persists in itself or in its habitual movements, but the place of the one becomes more and more loosened. The others are broken, crushed, more and more rejected, becoming weak in their intensity, limp or mechanical in their action. As the sanction is withdrawn from them, they spend what energy they have and they begin to wind down. Ego loses its force and no longer defines the individual. Rather, the soul shines forth. In the end, there is a constant giving up of the whole consciousness into the being of the Supreme. In the beginning, when the restless confusion and obscuring impurity of our outward nature is active, when the mental, vital, physical ego sense are still powerful, this new mental outlook, these experiences may be found difficult in the extreme. But once that triple egoism is discouraged or moribund, and the instruments of the spirit are set right and purified, in an entirely pure, silent, clarified, widened consciousness, the purity, infinity, stillness of the One reflects itself like the sky in a limpid lake. This new mental outlook, this poise gained by which one can secure real knowledge, leads to this stillness. The Yoga Sutras has an aphorism. At other times, there is conformity, sarupya, of the self with the fluctuations. Conformity clouds the self within. This is Yoga Sutra's first section, the fourth aphorism. And this idea that the self is reflected like the sky in a limpid lake is often referred to in commentaries about this sutra. A meeting or a taking in of the reflected consciousness by that which reflects it becomes more and more pressing and possible. The bridging or abolition of the atmospheric gulf between that immutable, ethereal, impersonal vastness and this once mobile whirl or narrow stream of personal existence is no longer an arduous improbability and may be even a frequent experience, if not yet an entirely permanent state. In other words, the space between the buddhi, this enlightened will which begins to become interested in this reality that is reflected in its stillness, becomes less and less. So the space is attenuated. There is coming a merger so that one gets the real experience of the effulgent self and falls out of identification with even the buddhi and hence the rest of Prakriti. For even before complete purification, if the strings of the egoistic heart and mind are already sufficiently frayed and loosened, the jiva can, by a sudden snapping of the main cords, escape, ascending like a bird freed into the spaces, or widening like a liberated flood into the one and infinite. There is first a sudden sense of a cosmic consciousness, a casting of oneself into the universal. From that universality, one can aspire more easily to the transcendent. There is a pushing back and rending, or a rushing down of the walls that imprisoned our conscious being. There is a loss of all sense of individuality and personality, of all placement in space or time or action and law of nature. There is no longer an ego, a person definite and definable, but only consciousness, only existence, only peace or bliss. One becomes immortality, becomes eternity, becomes infinity. All that is left of the personal soul is a hymn of peace and freedom and bliss, vibrating somewhere in the eternal. So his language here reflects the impact and the immediacy of this succession of experiences, which were his own. It is biographical. So let's put a bookmark there, and we'll continue and hopefully complete the chapter next time. But something from Savitri. I think this is apt for our reading tonight. This is book one, the Book of Beginnings, Canto 4, The Secret Knowledge, and we'll start on page 46. Even when we fail to look into our souls, or lie embedded in earthly consciousness, still have we parts that grow towards the light. Yet are there luminous tracts and heaven serene, and El Dorados of splendor and ecstasy, and temples to the Godhead none can see. A shapeless memory lingers in us still, and sometimes, when our sight is turned within, Earth's ignorant veil is lifted from our eyes. There is a short, miraculous escape. This narrow fringe of clamped experience we leave behind, meted to us as life. Our little walks, our insufficient reach. Our souls can visit in great lonely hours still regions of imperishable light, all-seeing eagle peaks of silent power, and moon-flame oceans of swift, fathomless bliss, and calm immensities of spirit space. In the unfolding process of the self, sometimes the inexpressible mystery elects a human vessel of descent. A breath comes down from a supernal air. A presence is born. A guiding light awakes. A stillness falls upon the instruments. Fixed, motionless, like a marble monument, stone calm, the body is a pedestal supporting a figure of eternal peace. Or a revealing force sweeps blazing in, out of some vast superior continent. Knowledge breaks through, trailing its radiant seas, and nature trembles with the power, the flame. A greater personality sometimes possesses us, which yet we know is ours, or we adore the master of our souls. Then the bodily ego thins and falls, no more insisting on its separate self, losing the punctilio of its separate birth. It leaves us one with nature and with God. In moments when the inner lamps are lit and the life's cherished guests are left outside, our spirit sits alone and speaks to its gulfs. A wider consciousness opens then its doors, invading from spiritual silences. A ray of the timeless glory stoops a while to commune with our seized illumined clay and leaves its huge white stamp upon our lives. In the oblivious field of mortal mind, revealed to the closed prophet eyes of trance, or in some deep internal solitude, witnessed by a strange immaterial sense, the signals of eternity appear. The truth mind could not know unveils its face. We hear what mortal ears have never heard. We feel what earthly sense has never felt. We love what common hearts repel and dread. Our minds hush to a bright omniscient. A voice calls from the chambers of the soul. We meet the ecstasy of the Godhead's touch in golden privacies of immortal fire. Namaste. Jai Ma.